And so they set to work, settling almost instantly into a rhythm of work and rest. Mio would rise early in the morning, as was her long-established habit, and either run in the woods or train on solo techniques until Griffin got up a couple of hours after her. Following breakfast, they would spend the mornings training together. In the afternoons, she would either perform more drills based on suggestions he'd made during their morning session, or work on the extensive readings by the Katsujin Kenryu founders he had assigned her. Then another combined training session, usually followed by a sunset soak in the open-air onsen out in back of the cabin. All these things were done, rain or shine, only being suspended or moved indoors for the most violent of inclement weather. At this time of year, storms like the one Mio had arrived in hammered the woods every couple of weeks, but they were more common at night, by which time Griffin and his new student would generally have called it a day and gone inside anyway. They passed the evenings after dinner in more leisurely pursuits, reading, playing games, discussing the day's events, planning the next day. And thence to bed, where they usually lay side by side and talked of various things for a while before turning toward the walls and bidding each other good night. Every night, Griffin's sign-off was the same. Sleep well, Major. I'll most likely kill you in the morning. On the weekends, they changed up their game a little, occasionally skipping work sessions for the semi-recreational pursuits, such as excursions into the surrounding countryside, hiking down to the lake to have a swim, or heading over to the forest station to check in with Ranger Watanabe. Unlike the cabin, the ranger station had facilities for watching recorded movies, so on one Saturday afternoon, about 3 weeks into the project, Mio finally got to learn what Griffin's nightly remark actually meant. For 6 solid weeks they worked, and Mio's comfort level with the new style of swordsmanship she was being taught steadily increased. Normally, training a new acolyte from scratch would have taken Griffin years, but, of course, he wasn't training her from scratch. She was already a highly experienced swordswoman, trained since childhood in the military style of the Fuso Empire. Mio Sakamoto was a samurai of a very old school, far older than Katsujin Kenryu, long before she ever met the man on whom she had lately pinned what remained of her hopes. Instead, what Griffin was doing was converting her into a different kind of samurai. And for those purposes, Mio had effectively started as a sort of advanced journeyman, with the vast bulk of the rote training a blank slate student would require already in place. Katsujin Kenryu was not a martial art that insisted on students already versed in other techniques unlearning what they knew. Instead, one of the central tenets of the style involved regarding that old chestnut as little better than prideful folly, wasting hard-won achievements for the mere sake of asserting some nebulous moral superiority. The chief technical difference between Asagiri Katsujin Kenryu and the Fuso Teikoku Kaigun Itoryu, in which Mio was already so well versed, was that Katsujin Kenryu was a Nitoryu, literally a two-sword school, one that featured the use of both parts of the classical Daisho, the long katana and short wakizashi. As a practitioner of a strictly utilitarian military style, Mio had never had much occasion to handle the shorter swords. The Navy style dismissed wakizashi as quaint affectations of an earlier age, not practical battlefield weapons. She'd had occasion to see how questionable that doctrine was back in 1943, when she'd seen Griffin in action with the 501st. Not so much in aerial battle, admittedly, as in training on the ground. She hadn't been studying under him or trying to learn his style at the time, but she had practiced alongside and sparred with him fairly extensively, as a natural extension of her already existing strict training regimen. How else was another Fuso-style swordsman supposed to keep his skills honed, after all? Back and forth, and their bare feet tamped smooth the earth of the open clearing by the cabin as they worked. on hot days and cool, still and windy, days that saw sweat pouring down their faces, and days what they had to keep dashing out of their eyes was rain, they worked, laying the foundations for what Griffin hoped would be the answer to Mio's desperately heartfelt request. She occasionally wondered what he was working toward, building these intricate but ultimately mundane tactical skills and muscle memories in her, but she had sworn never to question his teaching, and she never did so aloud. Friday. Griffin sat immersed up to his neck in the hot spring, a folded towel on top of his head, and sighed as the last of the day's aches drifted away. An arm's length to his right, Mio Sakamoto did exactly the same thing at exactly the same moment. Behind them, curled up on the grass surrounding the onsen, Wolfgang joined in. Hearing the beagle's signature contented triple snort and sigh, the two humans glanced at each other, snickered, and then broke up laughing for a few moments before settling back again to soak. "You're coming along very well," he said. "I think next week we'll be able to start on phase two." Mio turned her head to give him a thoughtful look. Having read the works of the Ryu's founders, she had a pretty good idea of what phase two would be. An investigation into whether, perhaps as a lingering echo of her original magical power, she could be sensitized to the universal energy field, the thing Griffin had called like a kind of magic, that powered his own supernatural abilities. This energy, Katsujin Kenryu, after the ancient tradition of the Jedi Knights, one of whom had co-founded the Ryu, knew simply as the Force. If she could, and if she could be taught to tap into it and control it, it was Griffin's hope that the Force could be used as a replacement for her now lost capacity to generate magic energy within herself. He likened the concept to connecting a battery-powered device whose battery had failed to an external power source. If it worked, then there was a chance, only a chance, that Mio might do the impossible and fly again one day. Even if that didn't happen, she would at least be able to learn the superhuman fighting techniques at the uppermost levels of Katsujin Kenryu, which only the Force made humanly possible, and achieve some new and different measure of usefulness to the war effort. If not, she didn't want to think about if not, so she didn't. Instead, she smiled, settling herself a little lower so that her chin dipped into the warm water, and said, "I'm ready when you are, Sensei." The sun had just dipped below the peak of the mountain across the valley to the west, bathing the spring and its occupants in a fine red-orange light, when another figure came around the back of the cabin and hailed them. "Huh?" said Griffin, who had started to doze off a little. Looking up, he saw his landlady standing on the opposite shore, regarding him and his student with an expression combining surprise and puzzlement with what looked like faint, indulgent amusement. "Oh, hello," said Mio, sounding mildly surprised. "Good afternoon," said the young-looking woman in pink and red who had come upon them. To Mio's eye, she looked like she might be a Miko. She was wearing the kind of elaborate kimono and hakama ensemble the temple priestesses wore in her native Fuso, and she had that fresh, scrubbed, and wholesome look they tended to strive for as well. "Good afternoon," Griffin replied, smiling. "What a pleasant surprise. Mio, this is my landlady. I told you about her a while back." Raising a hand out of the water to make a sort of presentational gesture, he went on, "General Sakura Shinguchi of the Army of the Empire of Morita, may I present Major Mio Sakamoto of the Imperial Fuso Navy." Completely unfazed by her nakedness, one was, after all, supposed to be naked in the bath, and only a pointlessly unreasonable person would object to that, Mio put her folded towel aside, rose to her feet, and bowed very correctly, saying, Yoroshiku onegai shimasu, Shinguji Taisho. Sakura's response was equally perfect, taking no account of the major's dishabille whatsoever. She returned the bow and said that she was very pleased to meet her too, but please, let's not stand on ceremony. A short while later, dried off and more or less dressed in the stripy shirt of his she'd appropriated as night clothes on her first day here, Mio sat at the kitchen table chatting with Sakura, while Griffin, rather more dressed than that, fixed dinner. Not very much, to Griffin's surprise. Once they got to talking, Sakura and Mio got on like a house of fire. They had a very great deal in common, including the unexpected link of both being magic warriors, depended upon by their governments to defend their homelands against mysterious, inscrutable alien invaders. Before long, they had fallen to the favorite activity of all soldiers when gathered, the telling of war stories. Griffin, as it happened, had figured in some of those on both sides of the conversation, and by the time they finished eating and adjourned to the living room area, the two women were laughing and talking like old friends, and dredging up the most embarrassing available anecdotes about their mutual friend and colleague, who had figured in a number of both of their war stories, and now sat between them on the couch with a long, suffering face on. "You made him wear what?" Mio asked, vaguely incredulous. "Ha, ha, ha! I wish I could have seen that." "He actually cut quite a dashing figure," Sakura said, a trifle defensively. "Both in the Hanagumi uniform and on stage as a member of the Imperial Theater Company." She smiled nostalgically. "If we had Sumire here, I could probably convince them to reenact their signature duet from Chess." Mio, sitting cross-legged with Wolfgang in her lap, all but boneless with bliss at the comprehensive ear rub he was getting, laughed again. "I know he has a good singing voice, and that he can hold his own in a duet, come to think of it." "I knew this would come up," said Griffin. "Don't leave me in suspense, Major," said Sakura cheerfully. "At our old base in Britannia, we had a Fuseau-style bath, but it was indoors," Mio explained. "And since we were all women before Flyboy here turned up," she added with a little grin, "there was only the one. We took a vote after he came along and decided it wouldn't be fair to ban him from using it, but some of the other girls were shy. Well, I figured Barkhorn just didn't like me," Griffin put in wryly. "She's set in her ways, you know that," Mio said casually. "Anyway, it was an elaborate setup with a fountain in the middle, and the rule was if he wanted to be in there, he had to sit with his back to the fountain facing away from the showers, and anyone who wanted to hide could stay on the other side of the fountain." "Seems fair," said Sakura with an impish smile. "It worked for most of us," Mio agreed. "But our squadron commander, Mina, well, she's never really gotten used to the idea of a Fuseau-style bath in the first place, so she only went in there when there was nobody else there. I couldn't even get her to go in with me most of the time, and the one day I did, who wanders in about 20 minutes after we arrive?" Sakura giggled. "Oh dear. Luckily, Mina and I were already around on the other side of the fountain, so she didn't notice him and freak out right away. But we'd have to go past him to leave. I thought I might have to try to trick Mina into staying until he left, which might have worked if he hadn't started singing." "I thought I was alone," Griffin protested. "Picture the scene," Mio said. "I'm sitting at the edge of the bath with my back to the showers, facing Mina, who has her back to the fountain, and over on the other side of the fountain a man's voice starts singing. Poor Mina went white as a sheet, and I started seriously thinking that I might have to knock her out and carry her to get her to leave the room any time that night. And then she noticed what he was singing. It was the thing from Puccini's La Boheme. You know the part, O suave fanciulla, O dolce viso." Sakura nodded. We did La Boheme 1 year in the ITC. That's where I learned it, Griffin put in. The thing is, before the war, Mina trained to be an opera singer, said Mio, her smile now less amused and more sentimental. So when she realized what he was singing, she couldn't help herself. She had to join in. You must have been surprised to discover that you had a Mimi, said Sakura, nudging Griffin with an elbow. A bit, Griffin conceded. I didn't recognize her voice, either. I'd never heard Colonel Vilka sing before. But she knew the part, and, well, it seemed like the sporting thing to keep going. They sang it all the way to the end of Act One, and then he got up and left, without even trying to find out who his partner had been, Mio concluded. I don't think I ever thanked you for that, by the way. I know you didn't entirely mean to, but you turned what could have been an awkward moment into a really beautiful one. Mina was embarrassed, but... She reddened a little at the memory. Sometimes she likes being a little embarrassed. My pleasure, said Griffin Riley. Glad it all worked out. Well, I should get going, said Sakura, rising. It was very nice meeting you, Mio, and I hope you find what you're in search of. With an only slightly wry smile, she added, I can tell you this much, you're in very good hands. I know, said Mio, smiling. Aw, shucks, said Griffin. I'd get up to see you off, but... Mio added apologetically, indicating the happily snoring lens beagle in her lap. Sakura laughed cheerfully. Not at all, she said. As she turned to go, she noticed Mio's sword hanging from one of the pegs on the mantelpiece. A katana in a red lacquered scabbard. Its white leather grip wrapped in red cord, all its fittings a matte, anodized black. That's a beautiful sword, she said. May I? Mio nodded. Please, she said. Be my guest. Sakura took the sword down from its peg and held it sideways before her, right hand on the grip, left hand on the saya. What's its name? She asked. Repumaru, Mio told her, and then, with a sheepish grin and a hand behind her head, took me all night to come up with that, so be gentle. Sakura giggled. It's a perfectly fine name, she said. Then, with a curious expression, she drew the sword perhaps 3 inches, just enough to get a look at the temper of the blade. As she bared the blade, Sakura felt a strange sensation, as of something grabbing at her psychically. Involuntarily, her rose-pink battle aura manifested around her, bright enough to cast shadows. Mio leaned back slightly, her eyes going wide, as the exposed part of Repumaru's blade glowed with the same light, not the blue-white glow it had always shown when she'd infused it with her own magic power. Her face pale and dotted with a faint stippling of sweat, Sakura snapped the sword fully back into its sheath, cutting off the glow like a closing door. After a moment, her own aura faded as well, and the two women stared at each other, one in puzzlement, the other something akin to horror. "Did you make this sword?" Sakura asked, her voice hushed. "Yes," Mio replied. "Then I assume you know it's cursed," Sakura said in an almost conversational tone of voice. I do now," Mio said after a moment's hesitation. Lowering her eyes, she went on, "I didn't intend for it to be, but I was desperate when I made it, not thinking clearly. My intent got a little bit warped. But by then I was out of time. I had to have something that worked, and Repumaru did. Well enough. Or so I thought. She performed a seated bow, closing her eyes. I'm sorry. I didn't know it could affect you. I would have warned you not to touch it if I thought it would. Sakura turned to Griffin. You knew? I suspected, he replied. I was going to deal with it after we'd reached the next stage. I fear that would have been even more dangerous, Sakura told him, speaking much more formally than she had to him at any previous time that day. Something must be done about this at once. This blade should be reforged. For a moment, Mio thought of protesting. Flawed and dangerous or not, Repumaru represented an enormous investment of time, effort, and, in more senses than one, energy on her part. Yes, it was as much foe as friend. Yes, it had made her able to fight without her failed shield spell only at the cost of burning her out even more profoundly than carrying on without it would have done, leaving her completely powerless instead of simply weakened to the point of being combat ineffective. But until it had happened to her, she hadn't realized that she would even care about the difference between the two endings, and she still treasured those fleeting moments of triumph it had given her at the beginning of the Romagna campaign. That sense, however illusory, that she wasn't finished after all, that she could still fight, still contribute, that everything might just turn out all right. And for all its faults, Repumaru had given her those. In the end, she held her peace. Partly this was because she felt that objecting would violate at least the spirit, if not the letter, of her vow not to question any aspect of her retraining. But mostly it was because she knew Sakura was right. Repumaru's flaw was too dangerous to leave unchecked. It had burned her out, and she knew its hunger extended to the power of any witch foolish enough to touch it. It had once made an attack on Miyafuji, similar to the one it had just made on Sakura, simply because the younger witch had wanted to get a better look at her beloved instructor's proudest creation. She could not, in good conscience, leave something like that lying around, even if she herself were still willing to risk its bite in return for its power. So instead of arguing, she bowed her head again and said, I understand, Shinguji Taisho. What must I do? It was a measure of the seriousness with which she viewed the moment that Sakura didn't chide her for over-formality this time. Instead, she hung Repumaru back on its peg and said, Tomorrow, I'll take you both to my family's ancestral forge. It's in these mountains, not far from here. The Shinguji have forged weapons there for centuries, since the early days of settlement here. My own blade, the spirit sword Arataka, was made there. Then, cracking a wry smile, she went on, With the tools of my ancestors and what craft the three of us possess, we should be able to accomplish something. Mio hesitated, then murmured an apology to Wolfgang and shifted him as gently as possible into Griffin's lap before rising, brushing down her nightshirt, and bowing as formally as she could. Thank you, Shinguji Taisho. I'm in your debt. You're very welcome, Sakamoto Shosa, said Sakura, equally formally. Then she shrugged off the persona once again, grinned, and added, But I thought I told you to call me Sakura. The Shinguji Ancestral Forge was exactly the kind of thing Mio had been envisioning since Sakura mentioned it. It was in a cave, a bit higher up the mountain to the north of the cabin, an hour or so's brisk hike away. There, the timelessly familiar facilities seemed to have been hewn from the living rock of the cavern's interior, and the tools, equally familiar, looked and felt like they had been there forever, as if waiting for someone to come and build a forge at which to use them. For the whole of the next week, she, Griffin, and Sakura worked toward a solution to the problem of Repumaru's curse. The one they ultimately came up with was not perfect, but, they all agreed, it was the most practical, and the best that didn't involve scrapping the blade altogether and starting over from scratch. This, even under the circumstances, Mio couldn't quite bring herself to consider. And to their credit, neither Sakura nor Griffin ever tried to convince her to do so. They understood the bond a samurai could form with a weapon, even a flawed and dangerous one. On Friday, they returned to the cabin at last, bearing with them the fruits of their determined labors. They were filthy, bruised, weary, and mightily sick of iron rations, but pleased with themselves and with the camaraderie that the ordeal had built among them. None of them seemed to think it was at all curious, nor even worthy of comment, that after showering off the muck and grime of a week's hard labor at the forge, they should all settle into the onsen together and accept the sunset as their right and proper reward. After a good long soak, when night had fully fallen, the three dried off, dressed, and went inside to get started on a suitably epic dinner. Wolfgang, deeply happy to be back in a place with a couch again, sacked out instantly, and his low, blissful snoring made a pleasant backdrop to the conversation as Griffin rustled up some dinner and Sakura and Mio sat at the table trading more war stories. Before long, they had broken out the sake, and by the time Griffin had finished prepping dinner and put it on the table, he had to move a full squad of dead soldiers to place it. Sakura was largely unaffected. She was a Dedian, with all the inherent ability to hold one's liquor that implied. Mio, on the other hand, was red-faced and distinctly more casual of manner than usual. She'd even started calling her new friend Saku-chan, which would ordinarily have mortified her even after repeated admonitions not to be so formal. As they ate and continued drinking, Mio's manner got ever softer and warmer. Griffin found this interesting. He'd never seen her drunk, even a little bit, during his time with the 501st in 1943. She considered herself too much of a role model for the younger witches in the squadron to indulge where they could see her, and they could always see her, so that was that. Now he was learning that, left to her own devices, she was a bit of a lightweight, and furthermore that she was one of his favorite types of drunk. Not that he routinely sought out the company of the intoxicated, but when he found themselves near them, he had seen that they fell into different types. There was the morose drunk, there was the mean drunk, and the mean drunk's dangerous cousin, the violent drunk. There was the loud, obnoxious drunk. There was the jolly drunk. And then there was his personal favorite, the I love you guys drunk. Mio Sakamoto, it appeared, was one of those. For half an hour or so after dinner, she regaled and increasingly amused Griffin and Sakura with declarations of her love for each and every one of her wingmates, officers and gentlewomen all, without whom this stinking war would frankly not even be worth fighting. They were the greatest group of fighting witches the world had ever seen, and the finest human beings to boot. She would go to the wall for each and every one of them and never look back. Even that thieving little Romanian, Lucchini. Even that King Hell Goldbricker Hartman. Oh, hey, that reminds me, she said, turning to Griffin. Erica wanted me to give you something if I saw you again before she did. What? Griffin said. But before he could take the question further, she'd taken advantage of the shape that syllable caused his mouth to make and planted a great big drunken 45-second Gallian kiss on him. Don't tell Truda, Mio advised him with a cheerful wink once she'd finished. And then, before he could reply, she fell asleep, slumping heavily against his shoulder and commencing to snore. Probably sound advice, Griffin conceded, bemused. Well, said Sakura, sounding impressed, I think that's probably my cue to head home. Don't leave me alone with a drunk naval aviator. God knows what she'll do to me when she comes to. Griffin protested, but his grin showed that he was joking. He got up, gently easing Mio's head down onto a pillow as he did so, and gave his old friend a hug. "Thanks for all your help." "It was my pleasure," Sakura assured him. "I like your friend a great deal. I hope you're able to give her what she needs." She reddened. As it were. "I don't think I'm equipped for that," he replied, winking, just to deepen her blush further. Then he let her off the hook and said, "But yeah, I hope so too. We'll find out in the next day." He glanced back over his shoulder as Mio rolled onto her back and uttered a sound midway between a snore and a cough. Or two. Griffin saw Sakura to the door, tendered a cheerfully declined offer of a place to stay the night so she didn't have to hike down to her home at the mountain's base in the dark, and shut the door behind her. He went around the ground floor, shutting off the lights, then stood for a few moments by the couch. Mio had turned onto her side again, curling up in a fetal position, and was breathing much more quietly. In the moonlight coming through the window, she looked quite composed and peaceful, not at all drunk as a lord. He smiled, gathered her up, and let Wolfgang precede him up the stairs to the loft, singing under his breath as he went. "What shall we do with a drunken sailor? What shall we do with a drunken sailor? What shall we do with a drunken sailor early in the morning?" Mio slept in the next morning, but when she did rise, she wasn't hungover. Didn't, in fact, seem to remember having been drunk in the first place. She just remarked that she must have been good and worn out after their week in the mountains, and she was sorry she'd missed seeing Sakura off after all her help. That afternoon, not long after lunch, the breakthrough came. Mio was in the yard, training with a single Bokuto. While Griffin watched and considered her technique, she ran through several kata, then switched seamlessly to improvisation, handling the wooden blade with an easy, calm authority, as she did battle with various imaginary foes, until a point came in the pattern where there was only one logical outcome. Setting herself, she planted her back heel, coiled herself, and with a sharp cry, launched herself into a fully committed forward strike.
"Hyaken no arashi!"
On prior attempts, she had managed 5, 10, even a dozen strikes before the momentum failed her and she came to a halt. This time, though, her arms and sword moved so swiftly they seemed to multiply, the blade cutting through the air with a hummingbird burr, creating the Hundred Swords illusion that gave the technique its name. At the end, she whirled out of the follow-through, and in the same smooth, graceful motion, swept the Bokuto clean of imaginary blood and sheathed it at her side. For a second, once it was finished, she stood and just breathed, gazing in thoughtful silence at the place where she had just performed the maneuver. Then, blinking, she turned an expression of delight to Griffin. "Nicely done," he said, and then he went on to say the words she'd been hoping to hear for weeks, words that kindled a glow of real hope in a heart she had once thought would never feel that warmth again. "You're ready." Face to face in the middle of the clearing, kneeling in seiza upon the bare earth, the two had been settling ever deeper into meditation for nearly half an hour before Griffin spoke. "With the successful execution of the Hyaken no Arashi," he said, "you've cracked open a door and taken your first look into a larger world. Now it is time to throw that door wide and embrace your destiny. Are you prepared?" "Yes, Sensei," Mio replied, not opening her eyes. "Very well," Griffin said. "Then know this, Sakamoto Mio. There is a fire inside you that cannot be quenched. It is the fire of life itself, greater than distance or time. It burns in all beings. It lives and breathes, warms and illuminates. Sometimes it consumes, but always it renews. The timbre and cadence of his voice were at once soothing and compelling. Mio felt the focus of herself narrowing to a point, looking inward at the shining point of flame of which he spoke, deep in the center of herself. "Concentrate," said Griffin. "Feel that fire within you. Let its light guide you. Let its heat warm you. And once it has done, look outward. Behold the living fire of the universe itself. Each tongue of flame, a being like yourself, awake and alive, loved and loving, fighting to protect and survive. From time to time, any individual flame may go out, but the fire never dies, will never die. All life is flame. All life is one." Mio drew a sudden deep breath, feeling the sense of heat within her blaze up like the Shinguji forge, as her consciousness unfolded outward and for a moment she saw everything. It felt like the day, long ago in childhood, when she had first tapped her magic, first realized she was a witch. Only dozens of times more intense, because now she was an adult, and understood fully how precious it was. For his part, Griffin felt the breakaway within his student as plainly as if it had been a visible, physical change. He smiled, remembering that transcendent moment when it had first happened for him, and spoke the final words, both initiation and benediction. "This is the Force." Mio's eyes snapped open, meeting his directly and unflinchingly across the arm's length that separated them. The left, clear and gray, glowed with a metaphorical intensity. So too did the right, but it also glowed with a rather less metaphorical energy, its iris suffused with a scintillating violet light. The signature, Griffin knew from older times, of Mio Sakamoto's particular magical gift, known among the magicologists of her home reality as witch sight. Unspeaking, what could words do to convey this sensation? She expressed her joy instead by lunging forward, her arms going around his neck, and hugging the stuffing out of him. When she'd finished, she stayed where she was, up on her knees, holding him tight, her forehead against his, for a long moment, then murmured, "Thank you." "You're welcome," he replied. They stayed that way for several more seconds. Then the moment ended, and they returned to their previous places, sitting César an arm's length apart. "Now what?" Mio inquired, her mouth quirking in a wry half-smile. "Now," said Griffin, "you're going to need this back," and he took her eye patch from inside his gi and handed it to her. With it back in place, she finally, fully looked like herself again, and he had to smile a little bit at the realization. Then he got to his feet and went briskly on. "And now comes the actual hard part." The second phase of Mio's retraining was, in some ways, the flip side of the first. In phase one, she and Griffin had been building on her existing kenjutsu skills to prepare her for initiation into the upper tier of Katsujin Kenryu. Now they used her training in those upper tier methods, all of which involved calling on the power of the Force in one way or another, to attempt a sort of retooling of her old magical abilities, adapting the spells she had once relied upon into Force techniques. The most fundamental powers were the easiest, because for the most part they were very similar to the magical basics every combat witch learned early in her training. Fighting witches were trained to use their magic for physical enhancement first and foremost, increasing their strength, agility, and durability beyond the limits nature would normally have imposed on their bodies. This was how a short, lightly built woman like Mio, even one in physical condition as superb as hers, could handle heavy aircraft cannon barehanded, and how her body could withstand the punishment of high-speed, high-altitude flight without any protective equipment, occasionally without even clothing worthy of the description. Some witches took this ability to unusual extremes. Gertrude Barkhorn, Griffin remembered, was fantastically strong even by the standards of her profession, able to carry loads in flight that were simply preposterous, and perform feats of physical power that could leave onlookers dumbstruck. He well remembered seeing her punch a deuce-and-a-half truck to death, bellowing, "Rot bedeutet anhalten!" at the stunned Liberian Army sergeant at the wheel when it had nearly clipped Erica Hartman on a busy London street. Her signature trick was to fight with an MG-42, a machine gun normally intended to be served by a two-man crew, in each hand, as if they were a pair of mini-Uzis. Jedi and Katsujin Kenryu samurai were taught the same basic augmentations, powered by the Force, and Mio Sakamoto proved a very quick study. Within a day or two of her awakening, she was back functioning at a high level, advancing rapidly into territory normally reserved for the IPO's highest-ranking Esper agents. By the end of day two, Griffin had revoked all the internal limits he'd placed on himself during her initial retraining, and their sparring matches became ever more epic. By the end of week two, had anyone been around to watch them, they could have been seen doing things like running through the forest canopy from treetop to treetop, covering miles of wooded mountainside as they played an endlessly varying, constantly seesawing game of tag. Mio had many things to adapt and adjust to during this period, and Griffin did his best to tailor the lessons plan so that she would never have to tackle more than one thing at a time until all but one of the skills she was calling on had been thoroughly mastered. For instance, once the physical enhancement part was instinctive, he could start throwing in situational awareness challenges on top of the physical ones. But before then, one or the other was the rule. "Think of what we're doing as like physiotherapy," he said one day, as they sparred with naked blades. "You're like a head injury patient learning to walk again. All the knowledge is still there in your brain. We just have to rewire around the parts that don't work anymore and get to some that do." The metaphor was inexact but helpful. It kept Mio from taking failure, of which, particularly in the early going, there was quite a lot, as evidence of personal inadequacy. Rather, she was recovering from an injury. There was hard work involved, but she had never been a stranger to hard work. Hard work was one of Mio Sakamoto's oldest friends. And if there were days when nothing worked right, there was no shame in that. It was merely proof that she wasn't finished yet. Casting the struggle in that light kept her focused and positive. On some level, she recognized that she was being manipulated a bit, but on another, as an experienced trainer herself, she knew that you had to manipulate the trainees a little to get the best out of them, so she held no grudge. Quite the opposite. She was also branching out into new areas all on her own, experimenting with things that Griffin, not sharing her specific abilities, couldn't directly help with. Early on, she discovered a new use for her revived witch sight. Before, she had used it primarily as a far-seeing ability, and to sense the hidden cores of Neuroi within their semi-crystalline structures. Now she discovered that, with a little concentration, she could also use it to accelerate her visual perception, momentarily creating the conscious illusion that time had slowed, while at the same time temporarily boosting her own physical reaction speed. She couldn't keep it up for long, a second or two of real time at most, but properly timed, that second or two could make a big difference in a tactical situation. The biggest moment for her, though, was the day when the time came to see about reviving her shield. All combat witches learned a basic shield spell very early in their training. For the great majority of them, including Mio, this manifested itself as a sort of directable barrier, visually identified by a manifestation of its caster's personal magic circle. The patterns in these circles followed standard conventions based on the school in which their casters were trained, so that, for example, it was possible for someone versed in the topic to identify a shield cast by a Fuseau-trained witch, as opposed to a Britannian or Carlslander. The shield was a simple spell, but also a demanding one. The amount of energy required to deflect a serious attack, such as cannon fire or a Neuroi plasma beam, was significant. For young witches, this was no real problem, but it meant that shield failure was one of the first and most reliable signs that a witch's age was catching up with her. So it had been for Mio. Shortly after her 20th birthday, shrapnel had pierced her shield during a battle, and within 6 months she could no longer even reliably stop a pistol bullet. It was this, initially, which had led her to forge Repu Maru, investing it with the ability to serve as a kind of shield by resisting enemy fire with its enchanted, energized blade, but at a terrible, ultimately unpayable price. Of course, she still had Repu Maru, and the companion she, Griffin, and Sakura had created for it at the Shinguji Ancestral Forge, either of which could still be used for that purpose. In the end, they were unable to repair her sword's flawed enchantment, but they were able to reduce its ravenous hunger, if not quell it altogether, by cutting the sword down into the wakizashi she would have needed anyway. They had also managed to attune it more closely to her, so that it would no longer attack other witches if they should chance to touch it, a change that took a great weight off its owner's mind. They further mitigated it by pairing the new Repu Maru with a companion designed to improve the balance of power, her new main blade, Hagane Kaze, a katana forged and invested in the Shinguji pattern. One of Hagane Kaze's jobs was to provide a sort of metaphysical counterweight to Repu Maru. When wielding them both, she could keep Repu Maru balanced in the force and stop it from feeding on her own life energies. With these changes, the smaller sword was not completely safe to use. It would never truly be that. But it was a well-known and eminently manageable threat now, and one Mio was more reasonably confident that she could stay on top of with a little care. All of which was very well, but as they trained harder and harder, and autumn's chill drew closer and closer against the flanks of the mountains, Griffin knew that Mio dearly wished she could find the key that would unlock her shield again. Even if she didn't really need it, even if she now had a viable alternative as opposed to the self-destructive one she'd originally created, getting it back would represent a sort of symbolic personal triumph that he knew she ached for. As with her witch sight, though, this was not something he could help with directly, for even the advanced force techniques of Katsujin Kenryu had no close analog to the shield spell. Some Jedi Masters could manifest such formidable psychokinetic powers from their connection with the Force that they could block or even redirect hostile fire directed against them through will alone. But even they largely relied on their weapons, contained plasma swords called lightsabers, to do most of the heavy defensive lifting. Katsujin Kenryu, too, had lightsaber techniques, and the idea intrigued Mio. But she'd decided early on that it would have been too difficult to explain such a thing to the powers that be back home, and there was the question of whether she could keep one working with the technology base she'd have available there. Besides, she quipped wryly at the time, I'm a Fuseau no Otome. Steel is in our blood. 5 weeks into Phase 2, they were sparring in the larger clearing, farther away from the cabin, where they'd relocated once matters started becoming superhuman, and they began to fear they might endanger the structure. Using both blades each and all their physical prowess, They would have looked to most outside observers as if they were really seriously trying to kill one another, exploiting every advantage they could find and holding nothing back. Steel rang against steel as Mio met a strike from Ryu no Ha, Griffin's Wakizashi, with Repu Maru. Her positioning was a little off. She was still slightly thrown off by his left-handedness, which rendered backward all her expectations about which of his blades would be coming from where, and the sword sprang from her hand with a stinging jolt, coming to rest point down in the earth a few yards away. Cursing, Mio shook her jarred hand, then switched to a two-handed grip on Hagane Kaze, meeting his next strike more readily. Pressing his advantage ruthlessly, he bore down with his superior mass, battering through her guard and sending her other sword flying from her hands as well, then swept in for the kill. She knew, of course, that he wasn't really going to kill her, even in the heat of a full-throttle sparring session like this one. Either of them in his position would pull the blow just before it landed and leave the other defeated but unharmed. All the same, she reacted instinctively, gathering herself to push him back with the force and try to buy herself room to regroup. As she raised her hand, she realized a moment too late that he was closer than she thought. Using only one eye, her depth perception was impaired, and that it was entirely possible she was about to lose a piece of her right arm. Griffin's longer blade, Ryu no Tsume, struck the air 2 inches from Mio's hand and stopped, its edge sizzling softly. Radiating outward, centered on her palm, was a glowing circular sigil about a foot in diameter, its central detail an intricately interlocked 8-pointed star. Mio gazed in wonder at the back of her magic circle for a moment. Then, her face reconfiguring into a fierce little smile, she set her will against the curious but familiar new shape in her still growing perception of the force, and pushed. With a sound like a hammer striking steel, the circle expanded to a full 10-foot diameter and moved away from her hand by a couple of feet, flinging Griffin back as if he'd been hit by a car. While he picked himself up off the ground, she withdrew the shield, then pushed it back out again experimentally a couple of times, satisfying herself that she had its new form locked into her mind and could reclaim it when she liked. Her visible eye filling with tears, she stood for a moment looking at her hand, calling a small version of the circle into being and then dismissing it over and over for a few seconds. A short way away, Griffin stood watching her, an oddly wistful little smile on his lips. Then, recalling herself to the present with an effort, Mio stopped playing with her shield, reassembled her composure, and went to retrieve her swords so they could start again. Mio didn't comment aloud on the development until they had finished for the day. Only when they had showered up and retired to the onsen, both of them indifferent to the increasing autumnal bite in the air, did she remark, "I'm not sure I can explain to you what today's breakthrough means to me. Losing my shield..." She shook her head. "It was proof that, train as I might, I couldn't beat the system after all. That despite all my hard work and determination, I couldn't escape what they call the witch's fate. It was the beginning of the end, and I let it define me for a while. Getting it back is like..." Hesitating, she considered, then said, "Like becoming myself again." Griffin nodded, smiling. "I'm glad. Thank you." "All I've done is show you the mountain," he said, shaking his head. "You've done all the work of climbing it." "But without you, I never would have found it," Mio insisted. "Well, maybe," Griffin allowed, settling back against the side of the bath. "Of course, this is kind of bad news for me." Mio looked somewhere between startled and offended. What? Why? He raised his head and gave her a wry smile. You're almost done. It won't be long before you won't have any more use for me. And then you'll go back to 1945 and leave me all alone. Oh, she said, looking slightly downcast. That's true. Then, mustering a wry grin of her own, she said, Not quite alone. She indicated the lens beagle, dozing, as was his wont, by the side of the bath while the humans soaked. You'll get to keep Wolfgang, but only because I can't think of a way I could take him back with me, she added. Griffin chuckled. Well, I suppose I shouldn't get too maudlin anyway. After all, you're not finished yet. There's still your final exam. He grinned. And before you can even take that, we have to fix your striker unit. This was a significant challenge, but not an insurmountable one. On the one hand, a striker unit was a fantastically advanced piece of techno-sorcerous equipment, the likes of which did not exist anywhere in Griffin's native reality. Mio's, moreover, was one of the most advanced production models currently in service in the time and place she came from. On the other, it was still a machine that was manufactured on Earth, or at least an Earth, in 1945, and some of its parts reflected that. The materials of its construction, for instance, were not for the most part exotic. And though the magic engine that provided the fuel was an esoteric piece of gear, the radial reciprocating engine it powered was exactly what it said on the tin, albeit astonishingly compact for the era. Also, though they didn't have any of the maintenance or repair documentation handy, neither Griffin nor Mio really needed it. Mio wasn't a mechanic, but she'd worked with Striker units for a long time, had been one of the participants in their development, working closely alongside the late, and by flying witches anyway, lamented Dr. Miyafuji as his chief test pilot. For his part, Griffin was a mechanic of sorts, with an abiding interest in aviation hardware, the stranger the better. As such, during the months he was stranded in 1943, he had spent a fair bit of his time up to his elbows in one striker or another, helping out the repair crews or one of the witches themselves, a few of whom maintained their own equipment. I love these things, Griffin remarked as he adjusted the etheric carburetor on Mio's striker's starboard engine. Dr. Miyafuji was either a certified genius or an authentic wacko, and I mean that in the most admiring possible way. I mean, it's a machine. It has... He gestured with a wrench. Pistons and spark plugs and oil and stuff. But it burns... Well, chi, basically. That's firmly in so crazy it works territory. He was a great man, said Mio from somewhere inside the portside unit's magic converter. I miss him. It's kind of ironic, but I knew him better than I knew my own father, and better than his own daughter knew him. She extracted her head from the access panel and gave Griffin a faintly rueful look. Miyafuji never mentions it, but I know she must be at least a little jealous of that, and it makes me feel bad. Not like I did anything wrong, but, well, she got short-changed, and in a way I was part of it. Griffin gave her a puzzled look, then nodded as he realized what she was getting at. Oh, that's right. One of your new kids is called Miyafuji, isn't she? I didn't put it together. Hmm, said Mio, returning to work. The professor's daughter, Yoshika. She was just a child when he left home to devote himself to the Striker project. I didn't set out to do it. Didn't even know I had for a long time. But in a way, I sort of replaced her in his life. She never saw him again. I was the one who was there when he died. 4 years later, she joined the 501st, and I thought that by looking after her, I could pay a little of that back. She chuckled, a wry little smile spreading onto her face as she worked. In practice, half the time it's the other way around, but don't tell her I said so. She sounds like quite a girl, Griffin observed. She's the best. The most powerful witch I've ever seen, and one of the kindest people. Chuckling again, she added, Some of them would never admit it, but the whole squadron's in love with her. You can't not be, once you get a good look at what she's like. With a thoughtful frown, Mio paused in her work for a moment, then looked up again and said, Come to think of it, she'd be a natural fit for Katsujin Kenryu. The sword that kills is the sword that saves. That's Miyafuji to the bone, the gentle soldier. She hates war, but she'll fight like a demon for the right reason. Well, Griffin mused, when you get back, maybe you should pass along a few of the things I've shown you. Maybe I should, Mio agreed, her voice thoughtful. After a week and a half of tinkering and fettling, a bit of improvisation, and one return to the Shinguji Forge to make a couple of replacement parts from scratch, they decided they had Mio's striker unit nailed back together as well as they were going to. That left only the final step, seeing if it worked, and if Mio could make it work. The night before the flight test, Griffin presented her with an item he'd been fiddling with in the evenings for the last few days. At first glance, they looked like a pair of old-fashioned flight goggles, like her colleague Shirley Yeager sometimes wore, with the right lens blanked off and painted to resemble her eye patch, white with a diagonal blue stripe. It's a little something I thought might make your life a little easier in the air, he explained, as she looked quizzically from the goggles to him. Try them on. Puzzled but game, Mio took off her eye patch and slipped the goggles on instead, adjusting the elastic strap so that they would fit comfortably. Then, turning to regard him, she said, They're fine, but... She tried to push the right lens up so she could use that eye, and, as she had expected, found it difficult. This is actually going to make it harder to use my witch sight in combat. Griffin smiled. That's the beauty of it, actually. You don't even need to touch them. Try it. Just leave them in place and think about using your witch eye. She gave him a curious look, but did as he asked, lowering her hands. The goggles suddenly switched, the left lens becoming opaque and the right clearing. It took less time than it did to blink, and suddenly she was looking through the rainbow edge of his living aura and out the window behind him, across the valley to count the scales on a pine cone partway up the mountain on the far side. Startled, she instinctively tried to focus on his face, and, flick, the lenses swapped again, so that she was looking at him with her normal eye, and only her normal eye. How does that... she wondered, testing it again. It's controlled by your thoughts, he said, as if that were the most ordinary thing in the world. The headband has a neural mesh in it that can read your brainwaves through your skull. So the goggles know when you want to use your left eye and when you want to use your right. Save you the trouble of prying your eye patch up all the time in combat. I got the idea from a kid I know back in New Avalon whose left eye can see a couple of seconds into the future. You can imagine how disorienting that is if she tries to look out both eyes at once, he added with a rueful smile. Yes, I can, Mio agreed after a moment's reflection. Huh. What if I want to use them both at once? Oh, she said, as the goggles demonstrated that they could do that too. Well, all right then. Thanks. This will come in handy. You're welcome, he said. Think of it as an early graduation present. Or a consolation prize, she didn't say out loud.